Hello, beautiful, cherished people. As a lot of you know, Muriel is currently in England right now with her mom, and I'm about to hop on a plane and go meet them over there. So instead of putting out new episodes this week and next week and maybe the week after, I can't remember, for the next few couple weeks, we're unlocking some exclusive episodes from way deep in our Patreon catalog for free to give it to all of our wonderful, beautiful people. If you are interested in what's going on with us on our trip, you can actually join Patreon as a free option. There's a free way to join the Muriel's Murders Patreon option. You won't unlock all the exclusive episodes, but you can read Muriel's hilarious blogs. It's going horribly. She's going on this long walk, this crazy hike thing. It turns out they're climbing mountains and like snapping their ankles, not really, getting pneumonia, not really, but it's not pretty. So if you want to hear all of the hilarious mishaps and stay up on all that stuff, check out murielsmurders.com/Patreon. You can join as a free member and get access to all that stuff. And if you want to see some photos, find Muriel's Murders on Instagram. We'll be back in a small number of weeks with you beautiful people. And yeah, take care. Enjoy the show.
Muriel's Murder. Muriel's
Patreon Murder. Exclusive. Patreon exclusive.
Hello, I'm Muriel, and I love true crime.
I'm Nick, and I am not a fan.
Thank you for joining us. Each week, I force Nick to listen to me tell him a story of a true crime. Welcome to Muriel's Murder. Today, we're bringing you part two of our two-part series on the Texas I-45 murders, also known as the Texas Killing Fields. I came across this story when I was researching our Henry Lee Lucas main feed episode. As you can probably infer from the name, there's a lot of death in this episode, and it doesn't let up in part two.
Yeah, yeah.
Once again, the source material for this episode is the Jessica Dimmock directed 2022 Netflix docuseries Crime Scene: The Texas Killing Fields. Are you ready to get into it?
Do I have a choice?
No.
Okay, let's get started. Well, I don't think I have it in me emotionally to do the recap of part one, but I also don't think it's that necessary.
I think we know where we left off.
Okay.
And I am going to ask you for little mini recaps along the way. And the best part about this is that you just ask questions if you're confused. Because if you're confused, other people are confused. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it just means I did a crappy job.
No, so you're doing a great job, but I will say I did have a hard time keeping all of the victims' names straight.
Yeah.
So that to me is the biggest part. So if you say someone's name, like I can't even remember whose daughter it was, Tim Miller's, you know what I mean? Like, so that's like probably the thing that I feel the worst about.
I'll make sure to like make that clear.
Okay.
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 Last episode, we left off in 1997 with the murder of 12-year-old Laura Smither and the public revelation that these killings along the I-45 corridor had actually been going on unchecked for decades. We're starting out today in 1971, at the beginning of all this madness. So last week, we started our story during the downward spiral of the oil bust in Houston. Nick, right?
Right.
What was going on?
Man, a lot of people were making a lot of money because of a bunch of global political, geopolitical whatevers. In Texas, people in the gas business were making tons of money. And from the people working the fields all the way to the people in the fancy buildings. And then that all went kaput in 1985. And now everyone's broke.
Yeah. Plus all the helicopters, right?
Just can't and the Rolexes. Can't forget about any of this stuff.
This week, we start in the oil boom, and it's a whole other ball game. In 1971, this is right before the boom in 73, Houston was less developed, just on the cusp of the development extravaganza.
Sure.
And as the decade unfolded, it would see the wild explosion of growth and crowds of job seekers, including people like Clyde Hedrick, who is
a freaking murderer, most likely. Yeah. Our number one suspect. He's Southern ass Florida/Texas ass John Travolta from Saturday Night Fever, who is not a good guy.
Yeah, what practically did he do?
What do you mean? So, he was a roofer and he worked in the oil fields and he was hanging out. Her name was Ellen, right?
Yeah, Ellen Beeson.
Yeah, and he was hanging out, charming her with his dancing stupid ways with his sexy cowboy hat, and then probably drowned her, but then definitely dumped her body in a garbage pile.
Right. So he was a primary suspect for a while.
And plus, he's hanging around the bar where the other suspect, I can't remember her name, RIP, that I'll was do those bartending. Things.
Yeah. Right.
I'm getting worked up.
Yeah. So he lived in the same, there were two identified victims in the Calder Road Fields killings, and that was Heidi Fi. She was a bartender who worked at the Texas Moon.
Right.
And then there was Laura Miller, and she had lived two doors down from Clyde Hedrick in Dickinson.
Right.
Right. But that was a really good recap. This week, sorry. But for now, we start with a 6-month period starting in the summer of 1971. Between June 1971 and November 1971, 7 teenage girls ranging from 12 to 19 went missing between Houston and Galveston, Texas. All 7 were found murdered, and 2 of them, who were abducted from completely different places, were found in the same reservoir, the Attic Reservoir. And all of these cases had little to no evidence to go off of. There was no DNA testing at the time. And we kind of alluded to this in the last episode, but water and heat really speed up decomposition. So after a long summer, hurricanes, floods, and just the general marshiness of the coastal plain, most of what investigators found were skeletal remains in these cases. Mm-hmm. There were some similarities in terms of, you know, how they died. About half of them had been shot, but there really wasn't a lot to go off of. The 6th and 7th victims in this early 1970s group were Maria Johnson and Debbie Ackerman. So the 15-year-old best friends were known in the Galveston surfing scene and were last seen climbing into a white van with plans to hitchhike to Houston. They were found 2 days later in a pond in Texas City after being shot and drowned. And just remember, all of these places are within 20 miles of each other. They're very close.
Yeah. That's so sad.
After Maria and Debbie, there was a 2-year pause, but the murders resumed again in 1973, and this period continued up until 1977 with 11 girls killed in total and all the cases unsolved.
Just in that little period, or it extended to?
Between 1971 and 1977, there were 11 girls killed.
Okay, so it extended to 11.
Yeah. Out of all these murders, there was only one conviction. Michael Lloyd Self, who was a sex offender in the area, who after hours of intense interrogation, confessed to the murders of Rhonda Johnson and Sharon Shaw. Rhonda and Sharon, both 15 years old, were some of the earlier victims in 1971. And like Maria Johnson and Debbie Ackerman, the two young teens were friends, and they were abducted together in a pair. Their skeletal remains were found in Clear Lake, Texas, about 5 miles from the Texas killing fields, about 6 months after their disappearance. So Michael Self later retracted his confession and claimed to have been tortured by police, but was convicted anyway based on his initial confession. Mm-hmm. 3 years later, the officers who interrogated Michael Self were convicted of a bunch of misconduct stuff related to things like torturing people in their custody. Mm-hmm. Michael Self died in prison after serving 26 years, and many local officials, including the Harris County DA, believe he was wrongly convicted. Uh-huh. So out of these 11 girls that were killed or missing, one person was convicted, and most people believe that that was not the right guy.
Wow. Wow.
So now jumping back to where we left off last episode in 1997 with the murder of 12-year-old Laura Smither in Friendsville, Texas, mm-hmm. the public is finding out for the first time about the scope of what was happening in this area between Houston and Galveston. And in a way, there was a public reckoning to be had, right? The decades of law enforcement labeling these missing and murdered girls and women as drifters, runaways, hitchhikers, drug users seemed to have led to public apathy.
Yeah.
Laura Smither was a young girl from a good family in a nice neighborhood. She didn't hitchhike. She didn't have any bad kid friends. She studied ballet. And when she disappeared, the community galvanized around her case. Police did not tell her parents she was a runaway and to go home and wait. Police departments shared information. The FBI jumped in right away and thousands of people showed up to search for her. But if that had happened for other girls starting back in the early 70s, maybe the area wouldn't have been a hotspot for predators, or maybe the bodies would have been found more quickly, leading to more arrests, or frankly, any arrests. And maybe that would have prevented more deaths.
Right. I mean, you know, I could just imagine that community being like, oh, we are like not protecting our girls.
I think that that's what, like we had talked about, there's an article that was written for the Houston Tribune, I believe, or the Houston Chronicle, but you know, that author, that was her main thing. She's like, someone is preying on our young girls and young women.
Yeah. And we're all failing.
And nobody is doing anything about it. Yeah. Right. Like for instance, in 1996, just a year before Laura Smither was abducted and murdered, a 13-year-old girl named Crystal Jean Baker was abducted near I-45 about a half hour from League City while using a payphone at a convenience store after having a fight with her grandma. Mm-hmm. Her body was found 2 hours later and she had been sexually assaulted and strangled. But that case wasn't solved until 2012 after the advent of DNA testing. Mm. So even when they had the body, they weren't finding people until decades later, right?
Was this journalist in the documentary you watched?
I just read her a little bit of like what excerpts of what she wrote. But
oh, okay.
She wasn't in the documentary.
She wasn't, she's not a part of the documentary.
Yeah. Why?
I don't know. I just think that's a really cool thing to do with journal, you know, just that.
It's a huge piece.
I don't know.
Piece.
It's a huge piece.
Yeah.
She did this thing, you know, she gave a damn and she put together whatever she did.
Yeah. Her timeline is the one that, you know, appears time and time again. It's referenced.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah.
So we had this death that happened, you know, less than a year before Laura Smither was murdered. And then not to mention, they were just 6 years out from the Calder Road murders, this horrific, tragic, and blatant series of murders. Two of the victims were abducted from the exact same spot, and all the victims were just left out in the open, scattered in the grass in the same field. And it was hard not to imagine that if Heidi Fye's disappearance had been taken more seriously, the deaths of Laura Miller, Jane and Janet Doe, Crystal Jean Baker, Laura Smither could have been potentially prevented. Mm-hmm. Heidi Fye was labeled a hitchhiking, freewheeling bartender on an impromptu vacation. Laura Miller was labeled a troubled teen with pot-smoking friends who is smart enough to find her seizure medication anywhere. Which, like, if you do any drugs, you're like, that's not true. And then Jane,
your daughter is obviously in the mafia.
What are you talking about?
And also, even if all of those girls were all of those or actual horrible people, they should still be searched for.
Right. That's kind of what we're getting at,
right? Even if they're murderers, you should still search for them.
Right. And Jane and Janet Doe, who didn't have local family to advocate for them, were dismissed as drifters, right? And they weren't identified until almost 30 years later. So, like you're saying, to your point, it's in a way implicating the victims in their own death by blaming their behavior, you know, and this sort of unofficial way of designating a class of people who are somehow less worthy of investigating.
Right.
But now the Calder Road Fields killings were in the public eye again, and it was hard not to think the deaths were connected to the murder of Laura Smither, if not because the same killer was at large, then perhaps because of the relatively apathetic way police had been treating cases like this in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, faced with the magnitude of all of this, panic set in, like with the public. What on earth were they actually dealing with? The idea that they were dealing with a single mega serial killer who'd been active since the early 70s seemed kind of absurd. Like, while the ages and gender of the victims were relatively the same, the methods of killing seemed to vary a lot, and the large gaps between the clusters of murders seemed odd for one person to do. And then not to mention the Calder Road Fields killings had so many similar characteristics, it was hard not to think it was his own isolated thing.
Mm-hmm.
But if they just took the Calder Road killings as being a single serial killer still on the loose, why would there be such a big gap between his last murder in 1991 and then Laura Smithers' murder in 1997? Like, and why wasn't she left in the field? But there weren't any answers to those questions, and the murders kept coming. Just 3 months after Laura Smithers' body was found, 19-year-old Kellyanne Cox disappeared after making a call on a payphone in Denton, Texas, at a Conoco gas station. So this was way north of Houston, about 250 miles, but it happened right off of I-45, and it was strikingly similar to how Heidi Fye and Laura Miller disappeared.
Right, yeah, you hang out and just next to some payphones.
On I-45,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, these girls disappear without a trace. So in July 1997, when Kellyanne Cox disappeared and her car was found abandoned in the parking lot, police jumped into action. Just kidding. Police in Denton, Texas says there was no reason to panic and Kelly Cox was probably just a runaway.
Mm-hmm.
Her body wouldn't be found until 2016 in Clear Lake, about 15 minutes from Friendswood, Texas.
15 minutes. R.I.P.
Then, so that also means like this, she was abducted from 250 miles away and still her body ended up in the same area of the killing field.
It's just like, if someone's missing, just go there. Just go to those fields.
I mean, this isn't in the fields, but it's in that area.
Just go there anyways. Hang out in trees. Climb to the top of the trees and just look down and see if anyone starts dragging bodies towards you.
Nick Castellini's...
Detective. Nick Castellini's School of Detective Searching.
By now, Tim Miller, who was Laura Miller's father, that was one of the victims found in the actual field, mm-hmm. he was fully locked in on former NASA scientist Robert Abel. Tim was relentless and got a team of volunteers to excavate Abel's property, which, like, Tim comes off a little fanatical in this, but how did the police not do excavations on his land already? That seems bizarre to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think he gets a pass for being fanatical, right?
Well, because no one was doing things like excavating the land where they found four bodies.
Yeah.
Wild to me.
Yeah.
So anyway, I think you and I both feel Tim was rightfully feeling like he wasn't going to get much help solving his mm-hmm. daughter's murder from League City.
Right.
So Tim excavated the property with a group of volunteers that had a backhoe. They brought in cadaver dogs that actually indicated at the same point. They dug it up with an excavator and they found a woman's purse and some clothes, but no body.
Huh. So what, he just like bullied this guy saying like, hey, we're going to do this?
Yeah, I think he won. Uh-huh. And also Robert Abel is like, he always maintained his innocence. You know, he's like, I'm innocent. And he's always tried to be open and let people search the property.
Right. So he's like, oh, you guys want to excavate? Go. Of course.
Yeah.
Should have done this years ago.
In the background of like everyone that he knows, mm-hmm. that knows him, mm-hmm. knows him as a suspected serial killer. So his reputation's completely trashed.
Right.
So it's very, really tense. I don't know if it's like, I mean, I'm sure it's bullying to an extent, but it's also like he has a vested interest in being like, search the property, my name, right?
Yeah.
But anyway, the women's clothes and the purse, they didn't really lead to anyone identifiable.
Mm.
Eventually, Tim freaked Robert Abel out so much, he filed a restraining order and sold his property and moved away. Meanwhile, investigators were on the hunt for fresh suspects. They decided to pull a list of registered sex offenders in the counties around the section of I-45, which also, how did they not do this already, I feel like?
Yes.
And they found a whopping 2,000 plus sex offenders, just like so many sex offenders. And although they remained secretive, they did narrow down their list to a particular person. And that man was headed to a police lineup in the fall of 1997. So that's right after this rash of murders in 1997, starting with Laura Smither.
Yeah, the 12-year-old ballerina.
Right. So back in May of 1997, just a few weeks after Laura Smither's body was found, 19-year-old Sandra Sapar was getting creeped on by an older man in a black cowboy hat.
Caleb?
That's Caleb?
I know.
Don't be confusing people. Outside a convenience store in Webster, Texas. So Sandra was using a payphone outside a convenience store, just a five-minute drive away from the Calder Road field. So a five-minute drive away from the original killing fields in Lake City, Texas. Yes. Sandra said she got in her car and drove off, but she had to pull over on the side of I-45 when she realized she had a flat tire. And the man from the convenience store pulled up right behind her, smiling and offering to help. Then he abducted her by knife point.
Okay.
Sandra said...
Good timing, Muriel. Thanks Sandra for this comedic delivery of this horrible, violent crime. Thank you, Sandra said
she decided she'd rather die jumping out of the car and into the interstate than die by the hand of this knife wielding cowboy
disco
hat
dancer.
Well, wielding maniac, right? So she jumped. Someone pulled her out of the road. She survived. She was covered in road rash and blood.
Sure.
And
brave.
They took her to a local Waffle House and called 911. And
I thought you were saying that, like, chatted her up, you know, see if they have anything in common. Oh, thank God. Okay.
No, but over the months, as first Kellyanne Cox went missing and then Jessica Lee Kane, right? These girls that are going missing in succession after Laura Smither's murder. Police worked with Sandra to create a sketch of the suspect and then used hypnosis to help her recall details like the man's license plate number.
Whoa.
And finally,
yes,
in October 1997, police were ready to show Sandra a lineup of suspects. Without hesitation, she picked out registered sex offender and suspect in the Laura Smither case, William Lewis Reese.
All right. Not Caleb, a.k.a. Clyde.
Not Clyde Hedrick. And okay. I think that there's something to be said for this. I think there's something about this that's like illustrative of just how many people were hanging out up to shady stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And like not only did they both wear black cowboy hats, but actually the police sketch looked a lot like Clyde Hedrick at the time. So they thought it was Clyde Hedrick for a minute, but then they figured out it matched exactly with William Reese. And it's just wild that, you know, they're both kind of hanging out in the same area at the same time with shady connections, doing shady things.
Well, if they want the same thing, you know, they're going to pick up on the vibrations and be like, oh yeah, this is where I need to be.
Well, I mean, if you think about Clyde Hedrick, just to go back to the first episode, you know, he's connected by either being a neighbor or being a regular at the bar. He's connected to two women that we know of, or three. That died. Two of them are connected to the Blue Moon Club. One's a bartender there, and one, he met a girl there to dance. And two of them were abducted from the same payphone banks in Lake City, Texas. So there's so much similarity.
Right.
But then you have somebody like William Reese, who's also abducting girls from payphones outside of convenience stores.
Right.
Like a very similar like MO in the same neighborhood. So they're vibing off of the same thing, but they're so similar. It's just so crazy to me.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't think it's like, you know, I don't think these guys are like innovative geniuses.
No,
you know?
I'm not saying that. I'm just saying what a cool...
I could imagine them kind of like being the same kind of douche, doing the same douchey things.
I'm not even saying that they're... I'm not saying they're geniuses. I'm just saying the place is so saturated, it seems like, with people doing terrible things that there's just two guys who randomly just totally have the same vibe. That seems bizarre to me. Anyway... So William Reese moved from Oklahoma to Houston in 1997 after an early release from prison. In 1986, he kidnapped and sexually assaulted a 19-year-old woman. And then, while out on bail, he made bail, he went out and assaulted another woman. And so he was captured and sentenced to 25 years. He got out in less than 10 after being released on an appeal. The day Laura Smither disappeared, Reese was working construction in her Friendswood neighborhood, and he was released from work because of rain at the same time that Laura went out jogging at around 9 a.m. So William Reese, in this case, had been a suspect since really early in that case. And while he was ruled out as the Calder Road Fields murderer because he was in prison in Oklahoma at the time, Reese was also a suspect in another one of the other 1997 murders that or disappearances, the disappearance of Jessica Kane. Unfortunately, there was very little physical evidence in the Smither case and really no physical evidence in Jessica Kane's case because her body was still missing. So Reese was charged just with the kidnapping of Sandra Sapaw and sentenced to 60 years in prison. So now he's off the streets.
Okay. I have a feeling that doesn't mean the horrible things stop.
Well, that was it for a long time. The Texas Killing Field murders went cold. Tim Miller eventually apologized to Robert Abel in 2005. After years of being labeled a serial killer, Robert Abel drove his golf cart into an oncoming train and was killed at the age of 65.
On purpose.
They don't know. One or the other.
Well, pretty clearly one or the other.
I mean, I know.
On purpose or not on purpose.
Yeah. So that's what it is.
Probably wasn't trying to like jump the train.
You said on purpose, and I said, I don't know, it's one or the other. You're the one who's dumb.
Man, that's a, I mean, oh no, I don't want to make that joke.
Yeah, that's probably a good idea. Okay, if you're checking
gonna,
yourself.
Yeah, I'm checking myself. Okay, we're going to move on.
As for Clyde Hedrick.
I really want to say the joke, not going to, sorry. Nope, not going to do it. Keep going.
God, I don't have any idea what you could think of a joke. I feel like that's so tragic.
You know, it's only not tragic if he was a murderer, rapist.
Right. If you, okay, yeah.
You know what I mean? If he was definitely that guy, then
and
I would
they don't know.
Make a joke right now.
Yeah.
They don't know and I don't know, so I'm going to go ahead and say, don't speak ill of the dead. Might edit out that whole chunk. Okay, keep going.
So as for Clyde Hedrick, after serving his term for abuse of Ellen Beeson's corpse in the mid-80s, he went on to work on his rap sheet. He caught charges for enticing a child, criminal trespass, DWI, assault, terroristic threat, evading arrest, arson, cocaine, et cetera, et cetera.
That sounds like a great episode.
Okay, so he eventually got married. His stepdaughter Marla claimed he sexually abused her for years. After Marla turned 18, she went to police, you know, later in life with proof that Clyde had at the very least been taking pictures of her through a hole in her bedroom wall. Police took her statement but refused to level any charges against Clyde, so that just kind of died in the water and she gave up.
That is so horrible.
In 2012, almost 30 years after the murder of his daughter, Laura Miller, Tim Miller reached out to the FBI. He wanted a fresh look at Clyde Hedrick. And after new interviews and exhuming Ellen Beeson's body, a forensic anthropologist found a shocker. Ellen Beeson had more than likely died of a massive skull fracture that the original coroner had omitted from his autopsy report. So from what I understand, The coroner at the time,
yes,
had forgotten to photograph the side of the skull with the fracture. So they just omitted the fracture from the report. They couldn't go back. The body was buried. So they just didn't put it on the report.
You mean they're looking at a skeleton and they're saying, what happened to this person? And there's a huge fracture, like a crack in the skull. And that's not the top headline. Let's make sure we get 10 photographs of it.
It's a little small town coroner. He took a bunch of pictures. He forgot to do one thing. And then out of embarrassment, basically, he just left it out of the report. So that meant the evidence was hidden. It prevented prosecutors from charging Hedrick with anything more serious than abuse of a corpse. And this shoddy forensic work actually plagued the Texas Killing Fields case.
Sounds like it.
Right? I mean, you had the bullet that was boiled from last episode, uh-huh. like that they couldn't match to a gun because the evidence was stripped off.
Mm-hmm.
They had evidence that was lost. They had things like stained clothing and fingernail scrapings that weren't preserved. There was so little evidence remaining that just a few years down the line, when DNA testing became available, there really wasn't anything to test.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the forensic anthropologist who reopened the case declared that Ellen Beeson's skull fracture could have only come from an intentional attack while she was still alive.
Mm-hmm.
Not only that, investigators found some jailhouse snitches who claimed that while Clyde was serving his year-long prison sentence, Clyde Hedrick bragged about killing Laura Miller after having sex with her, and then he also was bragging about murdering Ellen Beeson. But jailhouse snitching doesn't hold weight in right. Texas court without matching evidence.
Sure.
So in the end, Clyde Hedrick was convicted of manslaughter in the Ellen Beeson case in 2014, and he was sentenced to 20 years in prison. He was not charged with anything related to the Calder Road Fields murders.
Uh-huh.
So time marches on. The next big development came in 2016. So William Reese was still in prison for the attempted kidnapping of Sandra Sapa in 1997 when the DNA that he had on file matched with a cold case from his home state of Oklahoma. In 1997, after he had been released from prison, but before moving to Houston, so just like months before he got to Houston, mm-hmm. Reese had sexually assaulted and strangled 19-year-old Tiffany Johnston and then left the body on the side of a dirt road in Bethany, Oklahoma. In order to avoid the death penalty in that case, Reese confessed to murdering both Jessica Kane and Kellyanne Cox in 1997, and he led investigators to their remains, and they were able to recover the remains. 6 years after that, he finally confessed to murdering 12-year-old Laura Smithers, ultimately taking credit for three of the unsolved 1997 I-45 murders.
That's just unreal, man.
Clyde Hedrick got an early release from his manslaughter sentence in the case of Ellen Beeson, and he went free in 2021 after serving 8 years. So he just is free and clear. But in 2022, just recently, in part because of information Clyde's stepdaughter, Marla, provided, Tim Miller, Laura Miller's dad, filed a wrongful death lawsuit against Clyde Hedrick for the death of his daughter in 1984, and he was awarded $24 million in a default judgment. So criminally, mm-hmm. Clyde Hedrick was never convicted of Laura Miller's murder.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the Calder Road killings, mm-hmm. right?
Of course.
But civilly, he was liable.
Did he get the money? Where'd that money come from?
I think that it might be symbolic. I know he has no money. He also has half of a jaw. He had cancer in his jaw. He's not doing great.
Yeah. They're like, oh, you're awarded $24 million from a man with no money.
I think I feel like it's symbolic. I don't know that much about anything about lawsuits.
Yeah. Okay.
There are a few more convictions over the years. One for the kidnapping of Shelley Sykes in 1986. There wasn't enough evidence for a murder charge, but mm-hmm. they were able to get a conviction. There was
against
one,
Clyde.
No, this is just like random different one-off people, right? So things that weren't connected to these larger cases.
Yeah.
There was one, you know, way later in the game, a DNA-based murder conviction for the murder of Crystal Jean Baker in 1997. And then there was another after-the-fact DNA-based conviction in the 1983 murder of Susan Lee Eads. So three of these kind of, like we said, we're focusing on these clusters of murders throughout the year, but there are all kinds of people who were murdered and abducted in between those clusters. So some of those were one-off things that were solved with DNA later.
Unbelievable.
But the majority of the dozens of I-45 cases remain cold, in particular the ones from the 1970s and the Calder Road Fields murders. In 2013, a guy confessed to murdering Janet Doe, aka Donna Prudhomme. That was the last body found in the field in 1991. But due to lack of evidence, no charges were filed. But there's one pretty nutty suspect that I'm going to leave you with. One person we haven't talked about.
Yeah.
Okay. And his name is Edward Harold Bell. So if you remember, way back in 1971, there were two girls, Debbie Ackerman and Maria Johnson, who were killed in 1971 near Galveston. They were best friends and they were local surfer girls, right?
Mm-hmm.
And back then, in that case, the FBI was actually looking at Edward Bell. And this dude was a doozy. He was a convicted sex offender. He'd been arrested in the area around 12 times for showing his genitals to kids. He lived on the beach in Galveston, and he was part owner in a surf shop where Debbie Ackerman and Maria Johnson used to hang out. And he also drove like a white van, which was the last thing they saw the girls getting into.
Yeah.
After Debbie Ackerman and Maria Johnson disappeared, and many other girls disappeared, Edward Bell bought a property in Dickinson, Texas, right? Coincidentally, where Clyde Hedrick was living. And that is pretty much a coincidence.
Okay. Like, literally a coincidence.
Yeah, right. So in this, but again, illustrating how small this world is, where like Tim Miller and his daughter Laura Miller lived two doors down from Clyde Hedrick. Yeah. And then this guy, Edward Bell, buys a property that's also in the same neighborhood as Clyde Hedrick. So they're all just kind of in the same pot. Anyway, in 1974, two middle schoolers from Dickinson, 14-year-old Brooks Bracewell and 12-year-old Georgia Gear, were last seen hitchhiking right near Bell's property. And I know it's a lot of names, but I feel like, you know, when we're talking about these girls, I'm just trying to say their names. And I'm going to go into their story because I feel like it's emblematic of a lot of these investigations. So Brooks and Georgia were labeled as runaways by the Galveston Police Department, and their disappearance wasn't even investigated as a homicide until 1981. Mm-hmm. So we're talking 1974 to 1981. It was just considered a runaway case and there was no investigation.
Mm-hmm.
In 1981, a Brazoria County Sheriff's deputy started looking into a box of unidentified bones that the department had just been holding since 1976. He's like, maybe I'll try to figure out who these bones belong to, right?
It's a slow Tuesday.
Right. And he thought, hey, what the hey? And he went back to the ditch where the bones were originally found back in 1976. So that's what, 5 years prior.
Mm-hmm.
And in the ditch, he found more human bones and old clothing that had just been lying there for years.
Mm-hmm.
And through that, he was easily able to identify the remains as belonging to the missing girls.
Oh.
So you have a 14-year-old and a 12-year-old that go missing. And it's literally like no one will investigate it.
Yeah.
And then it's just an accident. And then they go back to the place where they originally found the bones. And the investigation in the area where they found human bones was so unthorough that a police officer could just go back and find more bones.
Yeah.
You know, it's pretty wild. So back to Bell. Some years go by, and in 1978, Bell was sitting in his truck masturbating in front of a group of teen girls in Pasadena, Texas. This is about 25 miles from Dickinson.
Classy.
And Bell got caught by a Marine who was walking by. The Marine reached in and he took his car keys so Bell couldn't run from police. Mm-hmm. So Bell shot the Marine to death.
Oh.
And he fled to Panama, where he lived for 20 years undetected until he was caught and convicted of 26-year-old Marine Larry Dickens' murder.
Wow.
So in prison.
What a piece of garbage.
Yeah, I know.
I mean,
it's like,
it just doesn't stop with this
guy. It really doesn't stop. I was just like, what?
And what did he do in Panama? Just chill on the beach?
I'm sure. I
was
know.
He just like a great citizen down there? We don't even know those stories,
when
right?
When you start talking about people like this guy and Clyde Hedrick and William Reese, you think this is just what they're admitting to and what you can kind of connect them to. But if you look at what happened in the areas where they lived, that it's just completely unsolved. It's hard to imagine that they didn't do more things.
Yeah, and that's, anyways, okay.
So while he was in prison after being caught for Larry Dickens' murder, he confessed to the murder of 11 girls in the area from 1971 to 1977, mm-hmm. including the surfer girls, Debbie Ackerman and Maria Johnson.
R.I.P.
And then also the girls we talked about who, you know, just now who lived in Dickinson and their bones were in this ditch forever.
Right.
Brooks Bracewell and Georgia Gear.
R.I.P.
But due to lack of evidence, he wasn't charged in any of the murders.
Mm-hmm.
There's a 2011 documentary called The 11, all about Edward Bell's jailhouse confession, if anyone wants to check it out. I didn't have time to watch it, but I've heard it's pretty good. And I read a little bit of like the transcripts from it. So as far as I've read, the case for Edward Bell as the early I-45 murderer isn't super cut and dry. He knew a lot of details about the murders that weren't publicly published, but he also thought he had been turned into a sex offender by Franklin Delano Roosevelt under a state-sponsored torture program.
Okay.
So there's a lot going on.
Yeah, it's someone else's fault.
Yeah.
The president's fault. Was he the president?
Yeah.
FDR?
Yeah, FDR was definitely a president.
You know.
I love you so much.
You don't love anything in your life but yourself, Muriel.
Okay, great. So... Edward Bell died in prison in 2019. We'll never really know what happened with that.
Yeah.
There are still dozens of murdered and missing women and girls from that I-45 corridor area. The cases are still cold and new cases continue to pop up all the way up into the 2000s.
Wow.
And that's it.
And that's your Patreon for you.
Yeah. I started watching this documentary because I was just curious and it just was so, I just was surprised I had never heard of it. I think it's really popular, but the story, but I just had never heard of it.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's crazy. I mean, I guess we just took two road trips across the country. We went from Chicago to Seattle, then Seattle to LA, you know, you definitely go through towns that are like small little towns.
And you just think, you know, if it's a little town and on an interstate, you know, think of how many people could pass through that. And if you don't have stuff like traffic cameras, you know, and surveillance cameras and stuff.
Well, I mean, let's be honest. It's the, if you're a serial killer, it is the wrong time to be alive. Like you missed,
right now, these days,
you really missed your window of opportunity.
You know, it's crazy though. There's still a bunch of them.
They still do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess nothing will stop you if that's who you are.
Yeah. So this is kind of a precursor for what we're going to talk about next, or I guess it'll be 2 weeks from the release of it.
Yeah.
May 10th when we're releasing this other episode. This
so is how is it a precursor? Is this, it's just like from the same era, the same locate, like same geographical area. What's the connection between this and what we've got coming?
You know, I don't really want to tell you.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
I think that
it's none of the same people involved.
There are.
Oh, whoa.
Yeah. Really peripherally.
Okay.
So it's
right.
Not,
these are like little side things that you came across. You're
exactly.
Like, what is that? And
exactly.
Then we did this.
Yeah.
You're so good at your job, Muriel. Always going the extra mile, you know?
Yeah.
I do have a question for you.
What?
At one point you said the I-45 corridor.
Yeah.
But it sounded like you said the I-45 horridor.
No, definitely said corridor.
Okay.
I'm not too into puns.
Yeah, because I was like, oh, it is a horror, you know? Like a horror.
I guess maybe I am. I'm only into puns if I really lay it on thick to make you
uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to drop the I-5 horror door, but then I was like, you know, I got to get a kid or two living in my house that call me dad before I start making too many of those jokes.
Maybe you can teach our cat to talk.
Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for subscribing to our Patreon. You guys are all truly amazing and we love you.
Yeah, and thanks for all the suggestions. I'm going to keep going through them. I collect all of the suggestions for Patreons that people give me and I use them, but sometimes it takes me a while because I'm doing other things and I have the brain of a chimpanzee.
No,
you know, I think when Homer Simpson is like sitting there and in his head, it's like the chimpanzee with the symbols. Sometimes it'll just do that. So, you know, I try to get there, but sometimes I don't. But I am keeping them all in and I try to pick off that list as often as I can.
Hey, thanks to everyone who, you know, reaches out to us when there's like a credit card issue. I know the cards will get expired and you can't access the Patreon and it's annoying to like redo your credit card information and all that. Just know that we know that putting in your information to the computer is an annoying thing. And we just really, really appreciate you.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you very, very much.
All right.
It really means a lot. Okay.
Stay safe out there.
Yes. And God, please stay safe. I mean, Jesus. And make sure other people are safe too. Best you can, I guess.
Yeah. Good sleep. Drink some water. We'll see you guys.
No, don't fuck sleep and water. Stay awake.
Stop saying that.
Sorry.
You are just dropping F-bombs.
I'm sorry. I'm saying forget.
We literally have somebody who's like, thank you for not dropping F-bombs.
Okay, I'm sorry for cursing, but I feel very passionate about this.
She listens with her children.
What I'm talking about, Muriel, is that when I tell people to stay safe, I'm saying don't, you know, let people abduct other people or you if you can help it. You know what I mean? That's what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about drinking water.
I am saying in addition to that. People can do multiple things.
You know what, guys? Go enjoy.
I need this to be done.
Enjoy cupcakes. Okay, we love you. Bye.